from Trifecta Fitness. We're proud to be Clarksville's new Get Fit headquarters. Trifecta Fitness is a state-of-the-art spin and strength training studio. Our spin studio is truly one of a kind in this area, complete with 20 state-of-the-art live fitness bikes and an incredible sound system. Our strength training is done in small groups of six or fewer, and all of our strength and spin classes are scalable for every level of experience. Come see us in the heart of Clarksville, just behind MAPCO at the corner of Old Trenton Road and Wilma Rudolph Boulevard. Call us for more info at 931-542-6265 or download our Trifecta Fitness app for a full list.
This message is from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Did you serve in the military? If so, you can obtain a free lifetime pass to more than 2,000 federal recreation sites. These sites are located across more than 400 million acres of public lands, including national parks, wildlife refuges, and forests. The lands host activities to fit any lifestyle: hiking, biking, fishing, camping, and much more. Gold Star families are also eligible for these free lifetime passes. Plus, they cover entrance fees for a driver and all passengers in a car, or up to three additional adults at sites that charge per person. Obtaining one is easy. Just go to the National Park Service website, nps.gov, or the National Park Service app.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome back.
Fit Nation. Fit Nation.
We are a show founded by a veteran and hosted by two veterans and a military spouse. Our mission is to get people to tell their story to the world. If you're an author, share your tips with Misfit Nation. If you're a musician or actor, our audience needs to know how they too can get into the business. Coaches, we love our coaches. Come on and share some of your tips with the Misfit Nation to help them become better versions of themselves. If you're a corporate leader or an entrepreneur, come on and share how you did it and how hard you have fought for success. If you are a veteran, first responder, or Gold Star family, we would love to have you come on and just share your story with the Misfit Nation. We always have time for you. If you're feeling down, alone, or starting to see the darkness, stop. Think about those who are around you. You are not alone. You will be missed. If you feel like your problems will be a burden to those in your inner circle or are embarrassed, dial 988. If you are a veteran, take option one. We need you to keep pushing forward. Don't make a permanent solution to a temporary problem. If you're a new listener, welcome to the Misfit Nation. Be sure to subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast apps and also on our YouTube channel at @_MisfitNation. Subscribe and click the bell to keep you up to date with our latest episodes and all of our news. You can also find us on Heroes Media Group and About Face Radio. Now, let's get to the show. All right, all right, all right. Welcome back to our Tuesday After Dinner show. We didn't think we were going to make it tonight. Had a little trip to the ER with our better half. All things are well. They treated her just like soldiers were treated. Here's some naproxen. Go home. You'll be all right. Change your socks. So now we have a great guest, a U.S. Army veteran. He's a first-generation child of Iraqi immigrants. He's a proud U.S. Army veteran, author, deeply passionate about psychology. Following his service in the military, he embarked on a transformative journey of self-development. His books reflect his personal trials and the practical strategies he used for personal growth. Each chapter offers insights into the challenges he faced and the tactical solutions that helped him to overcome them. So without further ado, let's welcome U.S. Army veteran Dan Joseph to the Misfit Nation. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's awesome. We can link up with veterans and have them share what they're doing in the world after service, of course. And I think we linked in on LinkedIn, I believe, is where we had met. And this is great to have you here. Tell us a little more about you from as far back as you want to go, what you did in the military to how we got here.
So I was a combat engineer. I went to basic training, actually shipped out at like 32 years old. Went to Fort Jackson after that to OCS in Georgia, and then branched engineer, joined as basically as a sapper platoon leader. That was my first role in the military. I was only in for 3.5 years and then got out about a year ago. And while I was in, COVID hit, shut down a lot of stuff. It was a pretty gnarly time. And then I pursued a master's online when everything was, you know, when there was a stop on movement and just like the pipelines were closed down. So wanted to use my time to kind of develop myself as a leader while simultaneously leading a platoon. So that was kind of the academic scratch or itch that I got to scratch while I was a leader.
That's outstanding. At least you got that chance, and most sappers don't have that much time in their hands. So I guess with COVID, you were given an opportunity to do both. Because all the sappers here at Fort Campbell, I know they're in the field like constantly doing a lot of fun, glorious things that sappers do.
Yeah, it was. I was in a non-deployable unit, so we did a lot of the training for folks that were deploying, and basically op four stuff. So. A lot of simulated minefields. The ditches were real that were dug. The wire was definitely real. So the soldiers got to bang pickets around the desert. And I basically, watched them do all the hard work. I mean, a lot of the job of an officer is kind of just enabling the guys and staying out of their way as much as possible, you know, making sure that they can succeed and do the job. And I did get yelled at a few times for getting my hands dirty, because, you know, sometimes certain people will say, hey, that's not what an officer's role is. And we all know about how officers will try to be relevant to the guys. And then the troops are like, hey, sir, you know, we'll handle it from here. You can just watch. So that was definitely the tough part about being a leader. But, man, I just was blown away at how hard they'd work for, you know, for leadership to get the mission done. And the desert's unforgiving, you know, even though it was a training environment, 127 degrees in full kit is no joke, you know?
It is. It's not a funny joke if someone's laughing about it, but or if they think it is, it's not a funny joke. The desert is definitely unforgiving, especially when you add the hard work plus the kit, and it makes it a lot worse for all those involved. So I'm glad you were able to get that leadership background in the military. And then now you moved on. You have, what, 3 books now? Your psychology is your wheelhouse now, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So while I was in, I was working, basically I was trying to figure out what to get a degree in. And I thought, based on just my introduction into the military from basic training and OCS and then Bullock at Fort Leonard Wood, I realized how important it was to minimize the dumb stuff that I would do as a human being when it came to leading the troops. And so I figured a degree in psychology would just give me some more education on the science of basically feelings and emotions and leadership, and find an objective way of determining what optimal leadership looks like. And then working with a bunch of combat veterans really changed my life. So I worked with folks who were there in the initial wave into Iraq and into Afghanistan as well. I learned directly from them kind of what goes on in their minds, you know, the inner workings of their thoughts, stuff that they haven't dealt with, things that they are dealing with every single day. And as I applied my research and my kind of study in psychology, I was able to really, really fine tune, my approach when it came to working alongside them, because, you know, stuff gets dumb real fast, right? Out in the field. I mean, anything that can break is going to break. Anything that's going to go wrong is going to go wrong. And when you're working alongside somebody who's battling the demons that a lot of these guys have, it's so important to, especially as a leader, to minimize pressure wherever possible, just in the way we talk to them, in the way we interact with them. And I mean, the best thing you could do as a new officer for anybody listening is, dude, when you've got an NCO who's been there and done that, I mean, you take notes and you learn from them, you know? And of course you want to be a leader who's hands-on at some point and actionable and whatnot, but it's amazing how much pressure is lifted off their backs of the soldiers when you show them that they do get a voice. You know, and this is a point of contention, because is it supposed to be a one-way dialogue when you give orders, or you're supposed to let them talk? And man, I still it's still a battle. There's still an argument that it's a deep one, man. There's a deep philosophy to this.
It definitely is. And in that statement, it would come down to it depends. So here's the order to do X. Hey, sir, how about we do it this way? That's fine. But hey, you need to do this, then they shouldn't be asking that question. It was the philosophy that you'll hear back, the feedback you'll get from many senior leaders.
Yeah.
So as you now you've transitioned out, you said last year or the beginning of this year, are you practicing full time on just being you get your author business? That's a business in itself, being an author. Congratulations on all your work there.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Are you coaching people as well with mental health and development and such like that?
So I'm busy sweating in my car right now. I apologize to your viewers. I'm actually on a Navy base. If you hear like fighter jets, there's like F-35s and stuff flying around. So I might crack open my window, but you're going to hear some jets. So anyway, so I'm right now, I'm in the middle of, I don't really want to disclose it, but it's related to the government. So there's a cool job on the horizon. Definitely going to be dealing with protecting America, and it's pretty cool. I'll be working with some veterans who are awesome. But that's on the horizon. I am currently the only coaching I'm doing. So I'm working on some more books right now. So that's been fun to just kind of like, get some thoughts out. The only guys that I'm actively, like, if I were to say coaching, there's some good dudes that I know in different pipelines who are training for either special forces or special operations, whatnot. So we do jujitsu together, and I write a lot about jujitsu. I was trained on the mats by some awesome people. I go to Jocko Willing's gym. So he's obviously super inspirational to be around. There's a lot of vets there, a lot of team guys, and jujitsu goes hand in hand with leadership, right? And mindset. So there's been some guys that I've been blessed to get to know, and they're younger dudes, younger enlisted guys. And they absolutely destroy me on the mats. I mean, one of them just 2 days ago, he's a wrestler, and the guy's like got 40 pounds of muscle on me. And wow. He just absolutely doesn't know jujitsu, but he just grabs my arm and does what he wants. And I'm fighting for dear life to defend against him. But we talk a lot about the psychology of leadership. From the perspective of friends of mine who've been to war, I tell them what they taught me, about what it's like to be in those fights and what a good leader looks like in those scenarios, and what a not so optimal leader may look like. And it's really neat to kind of see them light up when I tell them that as enlisted guys, and in my perspective, they're the VIPs in the room during a brief. It shouldn't be the officer who says, I've got this pen, and I write this schematic, I write these diagrams on the whiteboard, and you're going to go do that. And that's what it looks like. Rather, it's more of, hey, this is the commander's intent, but the dudes on the ground that are willing to take the bullet, they're willing to get shot first, they're willing to get blown up, they're going to lay their life down. That's precious blood, man. And it's so important for them to feel that they are the priority, right? Keeping them alive is the priority. And that's kind of my soapboxy thing I talk to these guys about as we're doing jujitsu, talking about mindset, talking about tactical breaths, how to throttle their aggression, but calm themselves down in the midst of that. And that's not something I came up with. That's what these black belts taught me. That's what these upper beltmen taught me, because they're just amazing guys, and they're super patient. And they will absolutely smash my ego to little itty bitty pieces and then help me rebuild myself back up on the mats, And so, I love the hands-on, the tactile approach, like the kinesthetic approach to mindset development. So just talking about feelings is one thing, but when you're actively grappling and choking each other out, and then you're talking the philosophy of what it's like to fight and to know your enemy, to understand yourself, man, I can just rabbit hole down this, but I'll shut up for now.
And you're making great points right there. And I was laughing because I had a guest on not long ago, Matt Schaup, and he's an author as well. And he talked about getting onto the mat with a, I think it was a 14-year-old kid. He's 40 something years old. And this 14-year-old kid, he said, oh, he's a little scrawny kid. I can beat him. And that kid choked him out time and time again. He said, how am I going to get this kid? And he finally just realized that the kid just knows what he's doing. He was using his mental toughness over him. Now, it doesn't need matter what size on the mat. It just matters, like you were saying, mindset and knowing what to do next, knowing your enemy, know yourself, and be able to fight through it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we learned combatives, which is basically jiu-jitsu at a minor level. And it is the same thing. You go in there and people would eye people up who they thought they can beat and try to get in there. And then they'd become embarrassed and were very upset. I went against an officer from West Point, and he wrestled all 4 years at West Point. And just from my years of experience with war and combat and training, I took him out in seconds because I just knew what he wasn't going to do. And I went for it and took him out. He complained and cried that I cheated. I said, it's combatives, man. Win or lose, I got you. See you later.
Dang, did you break some bones or what? It sounds like you gave him a bloody nose.
I put my shoulder deep into his esophagus.
The shoulder of justice. Yes, I've received that many a time.
And it's a painful thing. And I was on the other side of it before. I learned my lesson.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You learn.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about jiu-jitsu. You know, whatever you dish out to people, you've received it. So it's and that adds to the humility. You know, these black belts are some of the most humble people in the world. And it's awesome. You know, they never brag because they don't have to. The belt says it all, you know, but also their temperament, you know, they gained that black belt through literal blood, sweat, and tears, you know? And so it comes, there's such a sweetness to that. It's not like, you know how in the military you get rank if you don't commit a crime and if you stay alive, I mean, you're going to rank up, you know? But in jiu-jitsu and other martial arts, man, you're doing that because you're getting choked and punched out and all this stuff. Right. So I'd love to see it if in the military, like the day you get rank, you also have to go get choked out for an hour with a black belt. It'd be so cool if the rank went hand in hand with belting up. But I only say that because I needed that, man. I was an idiot for much of my life, and I really needed that hands-on mentorship. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. And then sometimes you need that little knock in the noggin, I like to call it, knock in the noggin, to get you focused and go to the straight and narrow. And it seems like you learned it. You were learning it before you got to the mats, I believe. You had your mindset going before you started your jiu-jitsu journey as well.
It came close after that. So I kind of left the party scene, stopped drinking alcohol, like, you know, 6-7 days a week because I was self-medicating. And then I met a group of guys that were super cool. I met some Navy SEALs who started kind of like teaching me how to exercise, how to be fit, how to have a mindset like them. And one of my best friends was a DEA agent. Just really cool guys that started, I noticed were way different than the people that I used to party with, you know, and I loved my friends that I partied with, man. That was my family. But, then I realized, hey, there's a different caliber of people out there where they're not doing drugs. They're not drinking, you know, every single day. They're out there, you know, risking their lives and doing things that are, man, it was so cool. You know, just the stories that they'd share with me for 30 seconds, which blow my mind, you know? And to me, they were celebrities. They were, cause you know, they don't talk about this stuff to many people, but when they share stuff with you, it's like, holy smokes, dude, this is some badass stuff, you know? And, that really changed my perspective. And a lot of them, because of their job, in order to stay alive, if in any case they drop a weapon or whatever it is, they train hands, you know, hand-to-hand combat. Right. And so, seeing that discipline and seeing that aggression and that, oh man, it was so cool, but yet with the humility, yeah, it was just mind blowing,
right.
Super aggressive, super violent when they need to be, and yet super humble. So I wanted a piece of that and just wanted to be around them. You know what I mean? I just wanted that to rub off on me. And jiu-jitsu came shortly after that.
It's outstanding. And I'm sure some of your resilience, I mean, your parents, they both immigrated from Iraq, well before you were born, I'm guessing. And that's a journey for them. That's a hard enough journey for anyone, not to mention someone that doesn't know the language or the culture, to come to America and try to assimilate and become part of the culture and show you that toughness they had, the mental toughness, dude. That had to soak in a little bit.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and you look at what's going on with like Hamas and Israel right now, and I understand people are politicizing it so much right now, but my parents are Christian refugees, and they basically escaped, you know, because you can't, in countries like that, they don't let you just walk out. You can't just say, hey, we're going on vacation. For whatever reason, they say, like, we're going to turn this into a circle of hell, and everybody here has to stay here, right? That's the mentality. Super dark. So my family had to escape, you know, one by one. They had to find their ways out. Thank God they did. And their my father passed away a few years ago on the 4th of July, which was quite fitting. His name was Victor, for Victory Day. He was born in 1945. You know, when World War II ended, and he absolutely loved America. My brother's a Marine. My parents, they dreamed of America while they were stuck in Iraq, because they knew they would see Hollywood movies, you know. And so my dad was like obsessed with Marilyn Monroe and James Dean, Elvis Presley, the Beatles. Like, my dad, that's how he learned English. You know, they'd listen to Beatles, they'd listen to, and so they just dreamt, because they knew there was something better, right? They knew that where they lived, that wasn't right. And when they got out, the big thing they taught us was like, look, you know, we're going to speak English in the house. You guys are going to teach us proper English. You know, my dad worked like 2-3 jobs every single day of his life. And they just let us know the opportunities that we were born with in America and that we had, that wasn't what was supposed to happen to us. And so we needed to be extremely grateful to understand how blessed and how protected we were in America, you know, because back there, anybody could get killed, or women could get raped, or whatever it was, and they wouldn't investigate, you know, especially because we're Christians.
Right.
We were looked at as another class of citizens over there. And so they definitely pushed us to remember, like, in America, man, any dream can come true. You know, any opportunities here, there's no reason to complain. And that's something that, especially now, man, my heart breaks because of what's happening in the Middle East. And it just reminds me of what my parents risked their lives to get us away from, you know, as their kids. And man, it's unreal, dude. It's unreal that savagery still exists on our planet.
And that level of hatred, there's still that level of hatred for, and just, it's an ideology brainwashed into people from birth, basically, to tell them, if they're not like you, they're against you and you must hate them.
Right.
Even in 2004, on the streets of Ramadi, Iraq, I had Christian women trying to give me their kids to bring home with us.
Yeah.
That's in 2004. Mm-hmm. And we already were in control of the country at that point. So that breaks your heart just seeing that and knowing that your family went through that. And that was probably 20 something years before that, probably, that they went through it. And it was still going on.
Dude,
persecution was still going on.
Wild, right? It's crazy. Yeah. But yeah, and I always like to say, like, on behalf of my family, like, thanks for serving over there, man. And to anybody listening, because that's the thing that blew my mind, you know, growing up and seeing the war in Iraq on TV and stuff. That's like the hell my parents escaped from, right? My whole family, my lineage, like, escaped from. And you guys were going in there to go fight. And the fact that you'd be willing to risk your life for, you know, people you don't owe anything to, it's just, it's heartbreaking, but it's also like super inspiring to see that. And just, I don't know, man, it's hard to put into words, especially growing up here. And then, yeah, knowing everybody was deploying and going over there to fight, it's like, wait, you're running into the furnace. You know what I mean? And, yeah, dude, it's just heavy stuff, man.
Yeah. It's something that I didn't think I'd be doing as growing up. I knew I wanted to be in the Army. I didn't think I'd be in Iraq fighting, because growing up, you see things. We thought we were going to fight Russia the whole time I was growing up.
Mm.
And then that's where we wound up. So you wound up in a non-LISCO battle. You wound up in a coin operation, basically, against insurgency. Mm. And it was a totally different ball game. And you had to learn on the fly and use that mental jiu-jitsu to figure out what was going to happen next, playing chess in your mind. What's this guy going to do to cause something to happen here? And it was wild. And I think that's something you're tackling via your jiu-jitsu journey and your psychology journey as well.
Yeah, man, definitely thinking, you know, they teach us in jiu-jitsu, everything's about a game of angles. And I was telling my buddy, he's in Buds right now, about to graduate and get his trident. But when we were rolling together, I was telling him how we're coached on thinking of every single move we set up as a game of angles. So you never go head to head with your opponent exactly mirroring them. You know, you either tilt your hips a little bit or your shoulders, you know, you find a way to come in, because that's when you throw them off balance, right? You just add that 1% of intelligence to each move, and it completely changes the game. So it's never like two, you know, stags hitting each other, locking horns and whatnot. But it can be very discreet. You can very subtly shift your weight or alter your angle in a way that your opponent doesn't understand that or isn't perceptive of it. And then next thing you know, you control their weight, you control the velocity of the fight, and you bait them into whatever move you want, you know. And they'd always say this on the mats. The black belts would always teach us what we tell you in jiu-jitsu. Think of it also as applying to real life. You know, any circumstance you're thinking outside the mats, it's philosophical. And again, a lot of these guys are combat vets, right? And so they bring in their war stories and they talk about how they've applied jiu-jitsu in that context. And it's so cool. And I love being able to share that with others.
Yeah, I reread Jocko's book, Extreme Ownership, 2 months ago. I read it when it first came out, and then I listened to it this time, listened to him and his co-author talk through it, and actually let it soak in this time. And just to listen to Jocko speak, knowing I was on the same streets he was over there, and the teams he led is amazing, the things that they went through. And it was 2 years after I left there, 3 years after I left there, he was fighting the same fight against the same dudes. So it was kind of wild to read it, listen to him, and see his points of how to twist what he did there into what you can do in reality, into real life with it. And if you can absorb what they teach, that's from him, his point of view. There's other people like you met the black belts. The other black belts all have the other points of view of where they came from to get that journey. And if you absorb all that, you're a better person.
Yeah, man. My army dad was there too. I won't say his name because OPSEC, but he told me about he was a young specialist over there in Ramadi, and because he was asking me, he's like, "Hey, ask Jocko if there's a certain thing going on there with like enemy snipers and whatnot." And he was like, "Ask Jocko if he was there with me at that time when we were dealing with that one guy." But essentially, he had to go blow up a bunch of trees to go set up some like corridors for snipers to like shoot in. And anyway, he had some super interesting stories about how Ramadi impacted him. And it's funny, cause when I was a new platoon leader, you know, he'd pull me aside and we'd talk about, you know, leadership stuff, right? How to talk to the troops. And I learned a lot from him, cause he's a pretty seasoned NCO at this point in his career. But it was amazing what he learned in real time over there. Like it came with a price, man. It came with a heavy price for him to have those lessons now that he has. And one of the coolest things, and I encourage especially new officers going in, is just letting these guys, if they're willing, you know, one-on-one share with you what they learned. Because it validates, man, a lot of the pain that they went through, a lot of the weight that they carry. And to be able to look at someone in the eyes like that and say, I'm going to make sure I incorporate your wisdom into my leadership. I think it's cool. I think that's it's the only way for me to give back, because I can't go back in time there and fight with them. But what I can say now is everything you learn there, like, let me soak it up. Let me soak up as much as I can. Because again, like he lost a lot of buddies and he wrestled with a lot of memories from those days. So just want to acknowledge that, man, the stuff that was normal to you, right? The stuff that was normal day in and day out is mind blowing, you know? And I won't go into details, but I'll just say, like, it's damn, there's some stuff he would drop so casually. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? You're going to have to repeat that, because that did not compute. Like, that happened. What?
He's like, just, oh, like, yeah, that.
Bro. Unreal.
Yeah. And I guess a live history lesson you get in there, a live life lesson as you're in combat, to either learn or you don't come back, and you have to learn, and where you're going to be the person that's getting a story told about them. And it is life altering, life changing. It could also make you a much better human at the end of the day. And I think that happens to a lot of people, to become much better humans after seeing the hell of battle.
Yeah, man. Assuming the assumption there is that they don't end up, you know, hurting themselves, right, or as one friend says, you know, moving their expiration date up. Right. So that's like, and again, that went into my leadership style, is understanding, dude. So a lot of guys, man, they wrestle with, why am I still alive? You know, my buddy's not, kind of a thing. And that's, that sticks, you know, it's a sticky thought. It's hard to just drop that. And I'm so grateful that, you know, my Army dad is still alive today, because there were days where he came close. And my buddy Austin, who wrote the foreword of my book, he lost 13 guys from his unit to suicide after Afghanistan, man. Like, 13 killed themselves, you know. And that's, you know, I still check in on him to make sure he's okay. Because he could have been on that list, right? And still could, you know, it could still happen, right? This is something we talk about, because we're not going to, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You know what I'm saying? There are days when I call him and, you know, if he doesn't answer and I know that he's in the middle of a struggle, it's like, oh, bro, like, don't leave me hanging too long. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then one of my soldiers survived his suicide attempt when I was platoon leader, and that changed my life. And he's still alive today. And he wrote, he wrote the introduction of my book as kind of from a soldier who struggled with that thought, you know, a word of encouragement to others. But this stuff is like, and not to make this like super heavy, I have a bad habit of doing that, but it's for guys like that. We need to optimize leadership. You know, it's not just to give the sexiest brief and whatnot. It's about how do I input some more resilience into this guy and help him become more robust, you know, because I think that's the big responsibility of leaders that we maybe don't talk about so much, is how do we lead in a way that's strengthening our guys, you know, and our gals, the troops.
I learned early on as a young leader from my leaders that my job is to make the next me. So my job was always to pump people up to be me or pass me. And that was my whole goal. Every time I had a new group, whether it was a team or a squad or a platoon, to get as many of them to become me or better. And that was my whole goal going through my whole career. So everything was transparent. They knew exactly why we were doing stuff, when we were doing stuff. And if I gave a brief, they briefed me how they were going to act on during it. So I learned those lessons way early from my first platoon sergeant, Humberto Lopez, who I thought was crazy at the time, but every lesson he taught me stayed in my head for forever now. So it was almost 30 years.
Hey, so when you, so even back then, right? So 2004, not to make it sound like super old, but back when you were serving, the why was given to you, or were they saying, because I've heard some guys say, well, back in my day, we didn't do that. Back in my day, you know, these soldiers weren't this spoiled, kind of a thing. But again, this is where something new officers should really get to know about. So when you were serving, did you get the why when you were told something, or was it just, I'm telling you to go do this, so shut up and do it?
Most times we were given a whole reason why. This is what we're going to do, and this is why we're doing it. Almost every leader I had did that. Yeah, I mean, I had a couple that were just authoritarian guys, or you do this, but those didn't last long because the soldiers wouldn't work for them. They would make them fail because they made them.
This is,
and that's the way it happens.
Yeah, man. So the funny thing is, because you know, I was mentored by some guys who were SEALs. One of them's out now. He's a really good friend of mine. I just saw him 2 weeks ago. But somebody called me out and said, hey, the way you lead soldiers, he's like, you're not thinking straight, because you were taught by team guys. You were taught how to lead by Navy SEALs, but you're not a Navy SEAL. You're in the Army, and you're giving soldiers like too much of a voice. That's not there as conventional soldiers. They didn't earn that. And I looked at them like, dude, they're adults, you know, they're adult human beings who are willing to die for the job. So they get the why. They get to give feedback. You don't tell them, oh, well, you're not team guys yet, so because of that, I'm going to treat you like X, Y, and Z, or, you know, whatever it is. But it was crazy to me. Cause this was from a fellow officer who was just thinking, yeah, you know, you're supposed to talk to them a certain way. And then if you're working with teams, that's when you treat each other like it's an equal playing field. But yeah. I don't know, man, that bothered me, but whatever.
And one of the listeners just wrote, in the Marines, we were told just go do. So
yeah, and I get it. And man, but like you said, if people, and again, I have not been to war, right? So let me say that. But I have been told by people who were in war that if soldiers hate you as a leader and you're trying to tell them to go do something, they're not doing it for you. If you're an officer who, you're going to do this, but they genuinely don't respect you, or they despise you, they're not going to walk into enemy fire because you gave an order. And
right.
I haven't seen it. I don't know, because I haven't been to war, but the guys who told me this are highly credible people. And so that's my only point of contention, is like, if you talk to people like they're stupid, and that tone of voice and that attitude and that, you know, posture as a leader, and then the rounds are flying and explosives are going off. Oof. I would hate to be abandoned by my platoon. You know what I'm saying?
So. And you don't have to look forward back. You can look back to Vietnam. The same thing happened. And the leader was not well loved, well respected. They usually were the first ones killed
in Vietnam. I heard about that. Yeah.
And so a lot of fratricide happened in Vietnam because of the same thing you just said. No respect for them, and someone would get rid of them, and then someone else would step up. And then now it's like I said, the authoritarian, you don't get nothing from them. They might go out there and make sure that their brothers that are right and left live and get back. But other than that, they're not doing anything above and beyond.
Yeah, this is, I love these conversations. These are the type of conversations I had with, like, again, with my Army dad. So I'd ask him from an NCO's perspective. Is it okay to be soft and show feelings to soldiers? Is it okay to give them a voice and hear how they're doing? Or does that introduce weakness into the ranks? Does that make them softer and make them feel like they're there to be coddled, you know? But, and again, that's when I wanted to invest in a master's to understand this stuff. Like, what's the neurophysiology of being nice? You know, what does it do to the brain when you treat people very rudely versus with kindness, you know? And all I can say, man, is the research looks good for being kind to others, because it nurtures growth in the mind. It buffers out the bad stuff. And I imagine being in war, you have enough enemies shooting at you. You don't want to be your own enemy. You know, why have an internal enemy if you've got the world hating you? So again, this is where it gets like philosophical and weird. So I don't know.
You don't want to worry about going to sleep at night and not waking up because someone didn't let you wake up. So that's a whole other ball game. So we've talked a little bit about your books. Tell us a quick synopsis of the three books that are out now, and then you have two on the way out. So, and where to get them.
So I have a website called Combat Psych. You can go to that and check out the books. There's previews on it. So Backpack to Rucksack book, that was the first one I wrote. That's basically a shout out to the guys who mentored me before I joined. So each chapter is dedicated to a different service member who inspired me to join the military. So there's Navy SEALs, EODs, Green Beret, MARSOC officer, jet pilots, rescue swimmers. It covers like enlisted ranks and enlisted guys and officers as well. But it's basically each chapter has a nugget of wisdom that they gave me about leadership. And I took that book and I distilled it down into the Combat Psych Handbook is what I call it. And I thought it would just be a cool book to take out to the field if soldiers are ever kind of bored out there and need some bullet points to read and whatnot. But what I did as a platoon leader, so I'd be sitting in my Humvee when we're out in the field together, and the Joes would come in, because I let the guys like sit in my vehicle and stuff. I wasn't weird about, you know, anyway. But I'd ask them questions like, hey, how are things at home? How's things with, you know, your wives? Or I had female soldiers too. So I asked them about, you know, their relationships with their husbands and stuff, or their kids. And I let them know, like, if you have any questions about psychology, ask me and let's see if I can give you an answer. And dude, we went through a ton of questions, you know. And at some point I even had the whole platoon there, and so the book is kind of based on topics that they asked me about, you know, whether it's anger, anxiety, depression, nightmares, like different things, interpersonal relationships. So I try to distill that down into a book. And then the one I just released, another one is a black belt psychology, like a mindset book, based on a thesis I worked on during my master's. and I got to interview 32 black belts. It was enabled because of Jocko. He gave me permission to interview a few black belts he knows, and then it kind of grew into this 32 black belt study where we talk about anxiety, basically threat appraisal, how they read threat, how they decide the amount of violence to respond to a threat, you know, where their mind goes when they're under attack. And so, yeah, that's a third book, and then just a bunch more that I'm writing, but I don't want to bore the listeners too much. They can check it out on the website.
And all through Amazon, basically.
Oh, yeah. They're, okay. Yep. And then one of them, the Combat Psych Handbook, that's you can get on Amazon, but the full book is available on my website as a PDF. Okay. And the reason I did that, there's a soldier who died after he got back from Afghanistan. He was struggling with some deep stuff, man. His mother wrote the foreword to the book, Tammy. She's a Gold Star mother. It's a heavy story. If you look up what happened, but I told her, you know, the heavier it is, the more real and the more it makes me just remember my soldiers, man, because soldiers come in with some pretty jacked up stories, you know. Yes. And that's what's so endearing about them, because in the middle of what they're fighting back home, the childhoods they grew up with, the animosity of things that they dealt with in the streets, you know, as young teenagers, these are the soldiers I led. And so, right. So Tammy, she wrote the foreword to the book, and out of just respect for Jeremiah not being here anymore, I wanted to give this book as a free resource to anybody. Like, there's no, you can copy it, you can send it to whoever you want. Because if it helps one soldier who's struggling, one soldier who feels alone, then, you know, then my mission's complete with that book, you know? So, I just wanted to say that it is a free resource, and it's because of Jeremiah's loss that I wanted to put it out there for the troops.
Awesome. And that's a great resource to have. The website is going across the bottom of the screen for those of you watching this on YouTube or on the live stream right now. For those of you who will see this, listen to this on our podcast, on all your favorite podcast apps, it will be in the show notes for you to click and check it out. Dan, at this point, I usually ask people three tips they give other people to be better at life. So if you give three tips for people to do better in life, what would that be?
Okay. Start jujitsu or do something hands-on, do something kinesthetic where you're, you know, iron sharpens iron, right? So find, especially for males, man, find a group of dudes who will absolutely pummel you and help you become a better person in that regard, because it does wonders for your ego. When you do that, so get on the mats in some capacity and learn how to throttle violence, you know, and be assertive on the mats. Number two is self-care. So definitely invest in your self-care. Google it, find out ways, or you can find it in my books and whatnot, but definitely work on self-care, especially if you're in uniform, you're going out to the field, especially if you have a high op tempo where you're at, invest in restoring your body and mind, you know. And then number three, man, I would say just reach out to your guys and your gals that you serve with, proactively, you know, check on people before things get weird, before people go quiet, just tell them, you remind people that you love them, and don't be ashamed of that, because, you know, if you're willing to lay your life down, that's the sign, that's the greatest love that you could show. And I believe because of that, we shouldn't be afraid of loving each other as family, because sometimes we're the only family we have, man, or the only family we can stand to be around. Right. So yeah, I would say, check in on others.
Awesome. Three great.
Here comes the helicopter, by the way. So it's going to be pretty loud.
I just had one go over me too. So it's kind of coincidental. I just had a Chinook fly over my house. Yeah. So, yours is probably a Pablo or something. So it's probably something cooler.
Oh, Osprey.
Osprey. Oh, it's even worse. Osprey. Yeah. Those lift your house. Dan, this has been great chatting with you. I'm sure we can go down a rabbit hole and talk forever on all the subjects we were talking about. It's been great. I can't wait to see what you do in the future.
All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You have a good night, brother.
All right, man. You too. Thanks.
For every veteran, there is a story. A story about a calling to serve, to fight for the freedoms of the American people. And every story has a struggle, a sacrifice, and invisible wounds. Warrior Wads programs help veterans recover.
Thanks for checking us out and being a part of this movement.
Don't forget to visit our website at themisfitnation.com. That's themisfitnation.com. Check out all of our past episodes and get some of that great Misfit Nation gear. As always, be humble, stay hungry, and keep hustling. Because we are
Misfit Nation. Misfit Nation. Misfit Nation.